Good evening, everyone. I'll be leading a review on karma tonight. Now, you might think, didn't you lead a review on karma previously? And I did, and tonight I'm actually going to cover some of the similar material. It's not because I'm lazy, it's because it's difficult material. And I thought it might be worthwhile to go over it again. It's been worthwhile for me to review it. And also, we have our two newest bhikshunis back with us and a few new people joining the community. So if this is extremely familiar to you and you've already developed a realization of it, then please just go to sleep or meditate. But for the rest of us, let's have a good review tonight. So let's begin by setting our motivation. Reflecting how the very fundamental nature of our minds is that it's always seeking happiness and always seeking to avoid suffering. This is the habit of the mind of every being. We wander from experience to experience, always looking for something that will make us feel better. Perhaps you've noticed that no sooner is one craving satisfied then another pops up demanding our attention. And this is the way that we spend our entire lives, trying to sustain some form of happiness and avoid suffering. Unfortunately, many of our actions cause us to create suffering, either because we don't know the actual causes for happiness and suffering, or we know the causes, but we have not yet developed the strength of conviction in the law of cause and effect to the point that our behavior consistently reflects that understanding. Would we ever indulge in anger if we had a complete conviction in the law of cause and effect? So just take a moment to check. What is my understanding of the general characteristics of karma? That karma is certain, karma multiplies, how we don't experience results for causes we haven't created, and karma doesn't go to waste. Just check, have I thought deeply about these four characteristics? Could I easily explain them to someone else? And what's my level of understanding of the presentation of the 10 non-virtues and their effects? Have I thoroughly familiarized myself with this presentation? Have I reflected repeatedly about the various factors that make karmic actions heavy or light, powerful or weak? We can genuinely rejoice in the moments when an awareness of karma protected us from negative actions or motivated positive actions. And we can also be sobered by how many moments of each day are still completely controlled by the momentum of karma. The countless moments when we're controlled by attachment to the 8 worldly concerns, controlled by anger, jealousy, pride, laziness. So let's engage in this review on karma tonight so that we develop a greater strength of conviction in the law of cause and effect and actually move closer to being able to truly benefit all sentient beings, leading them to a lasting state of happiness. As I was preparing for tonight, I noticed in the Lamrim Chimo, Lama Tsongkhapa advises us not to leave karma at the level of understanding, but to meditate on it over and over again. Why would that be the case? It's because karma is a very subtle and obscure subject, and it's difficult to acquire certainty about it, he says. So let's start with some general review, and then we'll go into some of those more specific areas of karma. So if I asked, what is the purpose of listening, reflecting, and meditating on karma? How would you answer?
Well, if we understand that our actions bring results, then we have to then we start tuning into what kind of actions am I doing. If I want happiness, what are the causes? And if I want, you know, suffering to happen, what are going to be the causes? So our minds get a little bit clear about what's helpful, what's not, what's virtuous, what's non-virtuous, and that it doesn't end at the day, the time of our death. It's like it just travels with us. So it gives us a little bit more of a long-term view that our actions like stick around with us for quite some time. You know, the results are going to be in there. So a little more mindfulness, a little bit more ethical conduct, a little bit more paying attention. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a very thorough reply. Anything else? No, I appreciate what you said. Any other ideas? Yeah.
Because if we're even going to have the very first motivation of being reborn, of cultivating, I mean, having a good rebirth, then we have to be very sober and clear about the foundation we're laying. It's the first step of creating that and practicing the path. So we may have great aspirations to be a Buddha, but if we haven't meditated on karma very much and are still behaving the way I do, then that basic fortunate rebirth is elusive.
Okay. Another good point. Anything else? Any pithy points you could summarize? Yeah.
Pithy points? I don't know about that, but I think it's very important if we want to progress along the path in regard to purification practice. So if I don't see the result of my karma, if I don't have an understanding of it, I have not such a strong urge to purify whatever I have done in the past, even those actions I can't remember from previous lives. And I even don't want to remember because it's such a cruel thing that I don't imagine I have ever done that, like killing or rape or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Losong and then.
In a real brief statement, so we know what to practice and what to abandon.
So we know what to practice and what to abandon. Okay, it's very succinct.
I was thinking that it helps me to think about what I'm doing, because I have to think about the future and what causes I'm creating for my future. It helps me to understand what I'm experiencing now and what I've done in the past. And so then that, I think, helps me to keep my motivations, to clean up my motivations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, yes.
This is a response from someone online. He says, it helps us prioritize our lives and encourage us to use even the most mundane things to create virtue.
Great. Okay. So, in what I heard, I heard a lot of the benefits of meditating on the law of cause and effect. Now, as you know, I really like the outlines because the outlines often contain clues or hints or directions. And so karma falls under this main heading of developing the faith of conviction in in karma and its effects, the root of all happiness and goodness. So all of your answers are spot on. But if we were going to summarize it, we could say the purpose of listening, reflecting, and meditating on karma is to develop greater faith of conviction so that we do all those things that you were describing. Okay? So remember, there's this formula that when we meditate on the benefits of something, that helps us to develop a kind of faith. In this instance, we're developing a faith of conviction. That's one of the three types of faith. And when we have faith in something, in the good qualities or in the workings of something, then we're more likely to have a strong aspiration to want to accomplish that. And with that strong aspiration, that's what leads to joyous effort, right? Joyous effort that we're going to need to engage in that practice, whatever the practice might be. And that joyous effort is what leads us to actually developing the wisdom of listening, reflecting, meditating on something like karma. So maybe that's a bookish answer. but I think the outlines can be very good clues for us to see what the author is, where the author is trying to steer our minds. Okay? So then how do we develop that faith? You know, by understanding the benefits or the advantages. And so you've already identified a lot of those. We're more likely to refrain from creating negative actions, even small negative actions, like you were mentioning today in the BBC about small actions fill a bucket and eventually fill an ocean, whether they're positive or negative actions. It encourages us to confess and purify, that was mentioned. Also develops confidence that we're creating the causes for higher rebirth within cyclic existence. That is the goal identified for the initial scope practitioner. Also, there's one that I didn't hear, and that is karma helps us, understanding karma helps us to accept hardships, how to bear suffering and experience pleasure with a more stable mind, because we know there are causes that have brought it about. So that can be another benefit. I'm sure there are many more benefits, but in a nutshell. So how can we meditate on karma? How can we follow Lama Tsongkhapa's advice? As I mentioned in the motivation, we can do analytic meditation on the four general characteristics of karma. So last time I did the review, we spent most of the session talking about those four. I actually like to think of those in the morning when I'm doing my three motivations. I have four motivations. Today, as much as possible, I'm not going to harm any living being. As much as possible, I'm going to benefit beings. I want all my actions to be motivated by bodhicitta. And I really want to remember that karma is definite. Karma multiplies. We don't experience results we haven't created the causes for, and karma doesn't go to waste. Then we get all those benefits that we listed. I mean, we could put every Lam Rim topic there in our morning motivation. Actually, we do that when we do a glance meditation on the Lam Rim, don't we? Okay.
One of the advantages I think wasn't mentioned is that we avoid the lower rebirths.
Okay.
By knowing karma and acting with virtuously.
Yes, so by creating the causes for higher rebirth, then we avoid a lower rebirth. That's right.
Because some of it's listed as the disadvantages and the advantages.
Yes, right. Thanks for that. Okay, so when we do that analytic meditation on the four general characteristics, then we're calling to mind the logic and reasoning that prove each of those, and also we're bringing in our own life experience to prove to ourselves that these general characteristics actually function the way they're described to. So then, last time, another way we can meditate on karma, I suggested last time that we make a chart of the presentation of the 10 non-virtues. I'm sure you all rushed out and did that. To make a succinct chart of each of those 10 non-virtues, looking at the different distinctions that were laid out in the Gomchen Lam Rim. Actually, he's following a Sangha in looking at the basis of the action, the intention. That's we talked about how that's maybe not a good translation or a problematic translation. That includes the motivation and the affliction, one of the three afflictions, the discrimination, the performance, and the completion. So by going through and actually pulling out, identifying and pulling out from either the Gomchen Lam Rim or one of the other Lam Rims, what are all those five characteristics, we familiarize. And I think this is one of the beauties of studying this section on karma, is that then when we have a question about, well, when we talk about karma, invariably there are people who ask all these questions. What about this situation? What about that situation? Is that a path of action? Is that a complete path of action? We have this template right in front of us that we can check. Well, let's see, is the basis there? Is the intention complete? Is the performance complete? Is the culmination complete? So we can begin to answer those questions for ourselves. We develop wisdom to be able to look at different situations that maybe aren't included in the 10 non-virtues. So that can be another way to meditate. Another meditation is to take each of the 10 non-virtues and really reflect where we clearly avoid that non-virtue and where we're likely to engage in it. So, for instance, with killing. Now, here at the Abbey, there's such a strong emphasis on guarding against these non-virtues that I doubt anyone has a problem with killing. But, for instance, perhaps lay people might draw the line at ants or mosquitoes or cockroaches in your kitchen or carpenter ants or termites, something like that. So just noticing, well, where is it that I might draw the line so that we can see where it is we might need to improve? Or like stealing. Now, I doubt that anyone interested in Buddhism would be actively involved in stealing cars or stealing property or anything like that. But where do we draw the line? Like, for instance, probably all of us have worked for an employer at some time, and we might have felt entitled to make copies on the company copying machine, or in this day and age, it's so easy for many people to download digital music that really we need to pay for. There are lots of little areas where we can easily justify or feel entitled to being involved in taking what's not freely given. So again, I think it's important to go through and just check to see, okay, well, where am I still engaged in these non-virtues? Another powerful meditation on karma is to meditate on the effects of the 10 non-virtues. Have you ever done that? Just gone through and read. This is the fruitional effect of killing. This is the causally concordant effect in terms of the experience, in terms of the behavior, in terms of the environment. Very sobering, isn't it? Empowering or motivating, actually. And another way to meditate is to look at the distinctions of the 10 paths of action. So there were two different presentations given in this text, as well as other Lamrim texts. The weights or the seriousness of the 10 non-virtues, we looked at things such as the basis and the attitude, the performance, the strength of the performance, things like that. Good to keep those in mind. And then there was another set of criteria for powerful actions that had more to do with whether or not we held vows, whether or not we were motivated by bodhicitta, things like that. So these are pretty straightforward, aren't they? Can you think of other ways to meditate on karma? Any other ways that you employ? Yeah.
One thing I did for a long time was I used those factors that make karma heavy, you know, more forceful. And I would use them to, when I set my motivation in the morning. So I just had, because I wanted to have a motivation that was really powerful. Mm-hmm. So that was something I did for a long time. So okay. I thought it was nice, because then I knew where it was.
Do I need to repeat the replies, or can you pick them up? Okay, good. Yeah.
I have, at times, when either when things are difficult or looking back over difficult, painful situations in my life, trying to imagine what was the karmic cause of that, and use that as a motivation to, you know, purify it and also to relieve any negativity that's still lingering about it.
A little bit like Venerable Chinni's, is that in the present moment when difficulties are arising, it really helps me to get out of the blaming mind and the finger-pointing mind and the it's not my fault kind of mind. Mm-hmm. That whether fortunate things come my way or unfortunate things, that I try to wrap my mind around, this is because you've created the causes for this to happen. So I'm connecting to my life rather than it all coming at me from some outward source, and I'm just sort of an innocent bystander that's being the recipient of somebody else's whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that I'm owning a lot more than I used to. It's helped all the sense of powerlessness, the victim thinking, the blaming, the finger pointing a lot. Mm-hmm.
Great. Yes.
It helps me understand, I guess, big news stories, tragedies. Venerable Chinni often talks about reading, you know, the paper with this view of, you know, it's just karma unfolding. Mm-hmm. Look at all the causes and conditions, and, you know, in some cases this is habitual actions that are just propelling people through this misery, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's helpful.
Very rich to use it that way.
For me, it's similar to that, only it's not so much on that level, it's more as times I've found in my life, like, I feel like I've worked so hard for something that it won't ever get there. And I realized from getting to know Venerable Jindy that sometimes when those kind of situations come up, where you're really striving after something but it never really comes up, you really haven't created all the causes. And I think of it more on a karmic level now, and it really helps my mind relax. I don't can just, you know, be go towards the side of acceptance and contentment and creating causes and not feeling like I'm beating my head against the wall.
Okay, yes.
Well, it's similar to what Venerable Sompton said. And it's sometimes very hard to see my own habits and patterns. So, but sometimes at work, I can see someone do something repeatedly over and over, and then see them experience very specific problems over and over. And, you know, maybe that's more like the immediate effect than the karmic effect, but, you know, just kind of trying to be observant of how people are and me are creating causes for things to happen. And we will experience it.
Right.
Trying to watch those connections with empathy.
Okay. All right. When we look at this section on karma in the Gomchen Lamrim, there are three main outlines. So the first one is contemplating karma and its effects in general. And I think I made a mistake last time. I said that this included the four characteristics. And then the second one, contemplating them in particular, included the 10 non-virtues. But actually, the four general characteristics and the presentation of the 10 non-virtuous paths of actions are all included in the effects in general. Then contemplating them in particular is that explanation of the fully what it takes to get a fully qualified body and mind in terms of the eight characteristics that we looked at the last time Venerable taught on karma. And then the third characteristic is, or the third outline is having contemplated them, how you turn from non-virtue and to practice virtue. So we had just begun that section. We were talking about downfalls and negativities and the difference between the two. So I imagine we'll finish up on the four opponent powers when Venerable teaches next week. So let's look at some of these more difficult points covered in this section. And let's look at them, let's try to look at them in isolated sections so that we really understand the terminology that's used in each of those sections. Because as we found last time, and this word karma is can be thrown about in different ways. Also, the term intention is used in different ways. And so we need to understand in each section what's being described, what's being talked about. So at the end of the section on the 10 non-virtues, there is this paragraph in the Lamrim Chimmo. Now, it's not found in our text, Gomchen Lamrim, but Venerable taught on it, I think, or maybe I did. Can't remember now. Maybe I brought it in last time. So if we look at the 10 non-virtues, any of the 10 can be motivated by any of the three poisons, attachment, anger, or ignorance. And I think I also mentioned that they're brought to completion by one of the non-virtues in particular. So, for instance, killing, harsh speech, and malice, the initial motivation could be any of the three poisons. So when we look at that scenario of, first of all, there's self-grasping ignorance that gives rise to some kind of affliction, that gives rise to an action, or actually more precisely we'd say that gives rise to a performance. But in the Lamrim, typically it says action there, or in different texts. That places a karmic seed or potential on the mind, and that seed, when all the conditions come together, that gives rise to a result of some kind of suffering result, since it's motivated by an affliction. Okay, so the initially, when we're talking about the affliction, that's the initial motivation. That's how it's described. It's actually, or the initial affliction. Then the concluding motivation or the concluding affliction is that those three are brought to completion by hatred or anger. It makes sense, doesn't it? Because they're a harmful intent. Killing could be motivated by out of attachment, out of anger, out of ignorance. But in the moment that the performance is happening, the affliction that's present is going to be hatred or anger. Is that clear? Okay. So then with stealing, unwise sexual behavior, and covetousness, the initial motivation is any of the three. Its concluding motivation is attachment. Wrong views can be brought about by any of the three poisons, but its culmination is brought about by, or it's accompanied by ignorance, motivated by ignorance. And then there are the last three, lying, divisive speech, and idle speech. Those can be initially motivated by any of the three poisons, and they can be brought to completion by any of the three poisons. Okay, so that's just a... is that clear? Would a picture help?
I got a little bit confused on how they were put together. Like killing, stealing...
Okay, so killing, harsh speech, and malice all go together.
And how was that decided?
Final affliction.
If we look at what is the motivating affliction at the time of the performance, like killing is necessarily going to include this intention to harm. So mm-hmm. is harsh speech. Mm-hmm. So is ill will. There's going to be some anger involved, some intention
okay.
to harm.
Okay.
Whereas stealing might be motivated, you might steal out of anger, you might steal out of ignorance or out of attachment, but in the moment of stealing, it's a mind that's clinging to something, it's wanting to have something
okay.
for oneself.
Okay.
So like that.
So that they're kind of categorized on what the main affliction is that's propelling.
At the time of the performance.
At the time of the action.
Yeah.
The time of the action.
So there's an initial motivation. When we look at a... okay, I'm going to draw it. I think it's just helpful to see. So we have this scenario. We say the root of all afflictions is self-grasping ignorance. And as soon as we exaggerate the sense of I, we're going to exaggerate the happiness and pleasure and the suffering or displeasure that I experiences. So we're going to immediately be involved in attachment for pleasure, whatever brings pleasure to this exaggerated sense of I, and be averse to anything that's threatening that pleasure. So this leads to different afflictions. Mm-hmm. When afflictions are present in the mind, we go into action. Mm-hmm. Or we could say, this is what I was saying, we could say performance. Now action, the word action, the Sanskrit term is karma. It means action. But we also will find that there are sections where the word karma is translated as intention. So we'll come to that. But for now, let's look at it like this. So this is the action or the performance that leads to planting seeds in the mind stream that eventually give rise to different results. So there's the story of our life. So what we're saying is that here's the initial... actually, affliction is something that's happening in the mind, self-grasping ignorance too, but it leads to afflictions. The way Gomchen Rinpoche explained it is that he said there's an intention that includes the one of the three poisons as the affliction, but also the motivation, like I intend to kill, right? And that's what he called the intention, or that's what was translated as intention. Maybe a poor choice of translation terms, but... so this is like the... Or we could say, okay, there's a motivation there, there's an affliction. This is what's being called the initial motivation. This is how Geshe Sopa's teaching was translated. Initial motivation. So this is before the performance. But then there's going to be a motivation that accompanies the action. That's the concluding motivation. So we said for any of the... And this is a whole... This is considered a path of action. We said that... just lost my train of thought. Okay, let's just leave it at that.
Which afflictions were happening when...
Right, thank you. So we said that any of the three afflictions can be present in this initial motivation, mm-hmm. but there will be, for most of those 10 paths of actions, there will be a specific concluding motivation that accompanies the performance or the action.
So that's different for what gets you all riled up due to the self-grasping ignorance is going to be a different affliction than when you finally decide to go ahead and do whatever it is.
Well, it could be the same, couldn't it? But it could also be different. Like killing can be motivated by anger, and it can be brought to completion by anger. But killing could also be motivated by attachment, strong attachment or ignorance. But it's going to be concluded. In the moment of the performance of the action of killing, let's say, the main affliction is anger or hostility. It has this intention to harm. Okay. All right, so that was one piece. Then in that same section, we have this statement that says, mental karma as intentions are karmas, not karmic paths. The seven physical and verbal karmas are karmas and karmic paths as well. The three, coveting and so forth, are karmic paths but not karmas. An action that an intention instigates is necessarily a karmic path. Luckily, there's a little footnote at the bottom that Venerable Chodron added, I think. It says, mental karma is the mental factor of intention. Now, this is something that the different tenet schools have different various presentations on what is intention, how do we understand it. So Great Exposition School and the Middle Way Consequence School agree that intention is karma, but it's not the only karma. The intended actions or the performance is also considered a karma. The Sutra School practitioners or tenet holders hold a different line, which is intention is only intention is karma. So what came much clearer for me today is that in part of the presentation, we're talking from, say, the Great Exposition, the Middle Way Consequence School point of view, but there's one point where Geshe Sopa points out that when we get to the section that's talking about the three mental karmas, somehow we seem to switch to, or the presentation makes more sense if we talk about it from the Sutra School point of view. He didn't actually say Sutra School point of view, he said from Vasubandhu's treasury of knowledge point of view. But I think we can say, because he's equating, it seems that Vasubandhu is equating intention with karma, or karma with intention, the mental factor of intention, we can say that's how the Sutra School presents it. Okay. So this brings up the whole discussion about actions and paths of actions. So just to be clear about an action, Geshe Sopa says, karma is mainly internal, an internal act. Karma or action is the intention, the intentional thought that's driving the action. So, for example, the seven actions of body and speech are actions or karma because they are the intentions to commit an action. So that what we're calling that initial motivation, we can call that an action. Or a karma. So we've moved now. Initially we were calling action, or karma, the performance. Now we're shifting that to include or specifically address the affliction and the motivation. Paths of actions, he describes as there are two different types of paths of actions. There's the cause of an intention. In other words, there's a cause to engage in a non-virtuous action. Or its object, meaning its actualization or the carrying out of the action. So let's look at those two examples. So the seven paths of actions of body and speech are paths of actions because they are the object of that intention. Or the object of that karma, that initial karma, the path of action down which the intention travels. So, for example, the carrying out of killing or the carrying out of stealing or whatever the action might be. The Lama Rinpoche describes it just slightly differently. It says they are paths of actions because body and speech are the basis of the intended action. So he's seeming to say that for something to be a path of action, it has to involve the body and the speech. It can't just happen at the mental level. So that's why, we could say that's one reason that the three passive actions of covetousness, ill will, and wrong views are passive actions, but not actions. Okay, so these three, covetousness, ill will, and wrong actions, wrong views, are passive actions because they are the cause or source from which an intention arises. Now this is a little bit tricky because the wording sounds similar, but if you read through the description of all those different branches of these three mental actions, passive actions, malice is the wish to harm. Okay, it does have an intention, but itself is not an intention. Now this is where Geshe Sopa says that the distinction is drawn more clearly from Vasubandhu's text, where karma is the mental factor of intention. So malice is this wish to harm, for example, but it itself is not intention. It's not the mental factor of intention. But it is the underlying cause from which an intention arises. So, for instance, malice could lead to the action of killing, couldn't it? It's not the action of killing, but it could lead to. Same thing with covetousness. It's the wish to possess an object. You might say, well, isn't that very similar to the intention or the motivation to possess an object or to steal? But they're making a very fine distinction here. So this wish to possess an object is not the mental factor of intention. It would be accompanied by the mental factor of intention, but it's not that mental factor of intention. Because malice and covetousness are afflictions. They're kleshas. So it's described that they're mutually exclusive from the mental factor of intention. One is a non-virtue, one is a omnipresent mental factor. Okay, so why is it? Yes, it's a omnipresent mental factor, but it can be virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral. Why is that?
Because it gets influenced by the affliction.
Exactly, it's influenced by whatever is else in the retinue of that main mind that the intention is accompanying.
More than the affliction.
Yeah. So this helps to explain. I always wonder.
The flashlights that Jeffrey talked about.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All these flashlights shining into a box. This is the great thing about Buddhist psychology, is that all these different mental factors are like shining into this box, and they all get mixed together and influence each other. And if one is particularly strong, you know, it actually influences the other. I don't know if I'm explaining that very particularly. But
I like the wording, they influence each other. But they are distinct mental factors. So to say mixed together, I mean, they are all working together, but they're just, distinct.
It's eliminated. Yeah. Together. And so it becomes not.
Right. Even the main mind gets influenced or imbued with that quality, even though those afflictions never become the nature of the main mind. Yeah.
When I recall about that analogy, maybe it was that they were different colored lights.
Yeah.
So that you had the impression that all the colors influence, and the strength of one might move the whole thing in a different direction. So it's not so much they get mixed, but it's the power of the influence.
Okay.
Of the different colors. It's very good.
Uh-huh. Nice analogy. Yes?
So, with having decided that it's not the action, but you have it all lumped as affliction, intention, and motivation, the affliction's not really the karma until it produces an intention to act, with the first seven, right? Like stealing, you know, I could have desire or attachment, and until it produces the actual intention to act, it's not really a karmic, going to make a karmic seed.
Well, this is an interesting thing to think about. For instance, if the scenario, if this path were interrupted at the level of affliction, you've still placed some seeds on your mind stream. But when we talk about a complete path of action, it's as if that complete, all of those steps now make one big karmic seed in your mind. But you could talk about them separately too.
So what I'm describing is it didn't create a complete karma.
Yeah. if it didn't create a complete karmic seed, there would still be karmic seeds placed on the mind stream. They may not be a complete path of action, but they still have, they'll give rise to a result.
But it should work the same also with the last three. If I have a desire to have something, it's still at the, it's not really the karma of covetousness until I've decided I definitely want to take action to get this object. Isn't that right?
Actually, covetousness is quite complicated. Has elements of jealousy and strong attachment, and there are five characteristics too.
It has to be the way we were taught is it has to be something that you develop, and it gets to the point of a real thought, of even a plan almost. You know, it's a developed thought, it's not a passing thing.
The plan is my point, is that it gets to the point where I decide, yes, I'm definitely going to act on this.
Right.
And that's what Geshe Sopa says in his book.
And that's what Venerable will tell us. But still before that, I think what you're kind of getting to is, what you're saying is that even before that, you're planting seeds.
Yes, but I guess I'm getting at is that the second thing, affliction, motivation, intention, it's when the affliction turns into an intention to act. Even with the mental ones, unless you're making...
You're saying karma? You're saying it's a complete karma.
Keep in mind that here, this word intention is a description of the affliction plus the motivation. So at the same time, there would be a mental factor of intention accompanying the afflictions, wouldn't there? And then with the action, there would also be a mental factor of intention accompanying that performance of the deed.
Before we do the deed, the affliction becomes a motivation that's, I will definitely, a motivation, we don't say it out loud, I'm going to speak harshly to somebody.
That's the motivation.
But once we have that motivation in mind, that's where it's already become a karma before.
But I'm wondering if you're mixing up karma and complete karma. You can have in the way you're saying that, they're kind of like almost using the words in different ways, like a complete karma is...
Like a complete path of action?
No, I'm talking about a completed karma. Complete karma belongs to another lifestyle. You have to have done the action.
That's a path of action.
But you're creating karma.
So
you're creating karma before you get to the place where you've completed the action.
With the first seven, you would have to go to the point of doing the action in order for it to be a complete karma.
Right.
And the last three... You're already there when you have the motivating intent.
Well, the interesting thing is that although when you look at any of the three mental paths of actions, they do explain an affliction, a motivation, a discrimination that's also included here, and an action. But it seems as if these two are completed. Mm-hmm. It's like they happen at the same time. Yeah. There's not something separate. That's why you say that coveting, for instance, is a path of action, but it's not... an action set aside that's going to motivate some other action. It's just one thing. That's how I understand it. Did that land? Okay.
That's not going to motivate. I thought that was exactly what has to happen. It's going to motivate you to go and somehow.
Yes, but it's. But we're not. When we look at the branches of, say, covetousness, it's not talking about, I mean, the performance is just coming to the, thinking about that. I wish to have that thing. I wish to have that thing. It's not, now I'm going to go out and steal it.
Oh, but that's what it's...
Well, no, it's I'm going to go out and do it, but it's not the going out and doing
it. No, it's all about doing it.
Mental.
But it's not just the wish, it's
she's
determination that I am going to do that.
She's on board with the event. It's all mental. Though.
But that's a nice distinction.
It's all mental, yes.
Yes, it's all mental. There we go.
But it's a mental intention or motivation that is intending to act.
Uh-huh.
That would lead... I mean, but
the distinction that Venerable Tarpa just added is that it doesn't have a next step, which is a performance, in addition to creating that wish to go out and get it.
Right. No, it's already complete.
Yeah.
Well, with a physical action, it would have to be the
right
next step.
But, so I have questions about this because I have no idea the answers. So with the three mental ones, are they are pathways of action. They're not karmas.
They're not considered karmas.
They're not considered karmas.
Right.
In the way that we've talked about this, because they're not body or speech.
And they're also not the mental factor of intention. So we can understand it in those two ways.
Yeah. But are they, can they be complete paths of action? Because that performance part of it is that part where you just, I'm going to go get this, you know?
Well, that's how it's presented.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Okay. All 10 are complete, if all the branches are there, they're all complete paths of actions. Mm-hmm. In and of themselves.
Complete paths of actions are complete. I only know it as complete action.
Okay.
Complete karmas. Well, I can't say that for those because you aren't calling them karmas. They have to say complete path.
Paths of actions, path. Meaning they're pathways to rebirths.
Yeah, right.
Because the main result of that action is going to be, you know, at least some aspect of that seed that's placed in the mind stream that can propel a rebirth.
So for those three, it's probably more discerning to say they're completed pathways of action because it's kind of confusing. Say they're not karmas, but they are complete karmas when you do all the parts. You know what I'm saying? So it might be better to...
Well, I have to look... Let's see how Gomchen Lamrim starts that section.
Yeah.
Actual non-virtuous karmic paths. So karmic paths...
Karmic paths of action,
they're really... It's a different translation of the same term.
Okay, but it has the paths in there. They're not just completed karmas.
Yes. Actual non-virtuous karmic paths. Yeah. See why we have to go over this again and again?
So can I just say what I think I heard?
Okay.
The three mental pathways are not karmas, but can be complete paths of actions, which means they are pathways to rebirths.
Yes.
I have a quote here from that says it's from the this is mental karmas as intentions are karmas, not karmic paths. And the seven physical and verbal karmas are karmas and karmic paths as well. So the three, coveting and so forth, are karmic paths but not karmas.
Right.
And an action that an intention instigates is necessarily a karmic path. It starts with mental karmas as intentions.
Right, because they're the mental factor of intention. Venerable Chodron added a little footnote below that. So mental karmas as intentions are karmas. So that's saying mental karma is the mental factor of intention. In plain English, that's what that means. Are you talking about the three mental pathways of covetousness, ill will? You know, it took me a long time in hearing these teachings again and again, and finally I went, oh, I probably do have covetousness. I probably do have ill will. You know, I'd kind of written them off because I thought, well, you have to have these five characteristics that would be present, and it'd be very complicated to actually bring that about. But then later, with more reflection, I realized, no, actually those five can come together quite easily. So if you think about times when you were ruminating about something, I have to have that, or ruminating, you know, about ill will towards someone who you see as someone who's harmed you, or someone you like, or stood in your way of getting what you wanted. You know, we can notice those actions of rumination, right? Coming back to the object again and again with a similar intention, or...
Yeah.
Go back and read that section on covetousness and ill will, and just see if you don't recognize more of the mental activity of what's happening.
I'm talking about like before I met the Dharma, and uh-huh. you know, it's just going to
Did you ever have strong, strong, strong attachment before you met the Dharma?
Oh,
covetousness.
I mean, I feel this is going to be very long, I'm sure.
Yeah, covetousness.
Existence.
Probably there. Check.
But if you're talking about purification, can't you just say blanket statement? You recognize now that you don't want to have these, and I just purify all of it. I don't need to remember all the details on everything. You know, it's like I know for the going forward in the future, I don't want to have this will, or I don't want to have this or that. And, you know, I feel in my purification that that's valid. It feels like I don't have to. I drank up enough to, you know, when they talk about doing the specifics to make it alive, so I have regret. To me, it's regret. That's the key point. So I don't. The fact that I don't remember all the details or even previous lives, but I notice tendencies. I don't sweat the small little details. I go for, like, what is my motivation in the future and how can I get the regret strong? And I feel like that's a valid purification.
That's a good point. Also, in addition to that, we can think about this was the Buddha's great kindness in showing us these are the 10 most common ways that human beings accumulate negative karma that has the potential to project rebirth. So chances are, he's probably thought we did these. And so we just need to purify whether we remember them or not, whether we can identify them clearly or not.
I didn't understand the part about the purification.
It's just, it seems easier to recall and purify something where you actually did an action rather than just this rumination.
So mental action, you know, our minds are working all the time, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm thinking decades.
Yeah. That's action. Okay. Now, there's a section in the text that's very straightforward, I think, when it's talking about explaining the effects of complete passive actions. And so there were three, weren't there? Do you remember them?
Say that again.
Okay. When the effects of the 10 passive actions are explained, there were three possible effects that were described. In general, three possible effects or results.
Results,
yes. Those two words are used interchangeably, it seems.
Environmental
results. Correctional. Causally. Concordant. Right. Now, interestingly, in the teachings on precious garland, I think that's where I found this, Kinzer Jompa Tegcho summarized it this way. You know, now we've talked about five branches here, but another way that the Geshe's often talk about these paths of actions is there's a motivation, there's an actual performance, and there's a conclusion. So he's linking the motivation, specifically the strength of the affliction, with the fruitional result. So the motivation here, the affliction in particular, is what's really, it's the what's creating the part of the seed that's going to propel the rebirth. Then the actual performance gives rise to the causally concordant result. And that would be in terms of both the experience and the behavior, right? And we can see how that would happen. The actual performance of killing, for instance, is creating the habit of killing, because we're doing it, and also we're creating the potential to be on the receiving end of a similar action. And then the conclusion, he said, is what gives rise to the environmental result.
The completion?
Yeah. I haven't been able to really link it up myself. I think it's one of those things that you hear and you go, let me think about that. Okay. So then we got into the section of the text that is the distinction presentation of other classifications of karma. So just very quickly, I think the presentation of projecting karma and completing karma is probably pretty clear. So let's skip over that. and go to karma whose result you will definitely or only possibly experience. Venerable Dhamsa asked if we could look at this a little more closely. So we have karma which is accumulated.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, this is good.
Okay. So now this. Let's just clean the page, okay? We're finished talking about those things. Just clean the page and we'll talk about, see if we, how we're going to use the terms in this section. So karma which is accumulated is karma that you have given thought to, or karma that you have thought of doing sometimes for a long time. And then karma which you have done. Now, the text is a little bit deceiving because it says that which you have given thought to or intentionally carry out with your body and speech. Here in Lamrim Chimo it says, karma that you have done is an action that you have thought about or that you have consciously set into motion either physically or vocally. Sometimes this or, this term that's translated as or, can also mean and. So I wonder if that's more accurately, we should just check on this. Because it's not either or. It's like you have both of those things. You've thought about it and you do it. Now, that's what makes something done, is that you've done it either physically or vocally. All right, now, it was a little bit confusing when it says, it does give very clear examples of karma that you have accumulated. Oh no, karma that's done, but not accumulated. So there's no, it lacks an intention. There's no intention to do these actions. So they give you 10 examples. Those done in a dream, those done unknowingly, those done unconsciously, those done without intensity or not continuously, those done in error, those done forgetfully, those done without wanting to, those naturally, ethically neutral, those eradicated through regret, and those eradicated with a remedy. Those are karma that are done. They've been done physically or verbally, but they're not accumulated because there was no intention. There was no accumulation, yeah, of that karma. Okay, so then what would be karma that you've accumulated is the remaining actions, the ones not included in these 10 types. Well, that might be a little confusing. All right, so let's just go through it. Karma that is accumulated and done is that which you have done in reality, not in a dream, but in reality. That which you've done knowingly makes sense, doesn't it? That which you've done consciously, that done with intensity or continuously, that done without error, that done mindfully, that done while wanting to. Those naturally non-virtuous or virtuous motivations, I guess. You know, it says, for the previous one, it was those naturally ethically neutral. So these actions that are, I guess you could accumulate neutral actions too, could, yes you do. All right, so accumulated and done would that be positive and negative or non-virtuous actions? I don't know. Let's leave a question about that. Yeah. Okay. Those not eradicated through regret, and those not eradicated with a remedy. Those would be karmas that are done and accumulated.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
It's strange to me that you call it something and then you name something that's done.
Yeah. Well, dreams are a form, aren't they?
That's what they say.
Aren't they? It's not really a physical or a...
That's what...
It's not like a mental
form.
Action, isn't
it's a
it? Yeah, okay.
So karma's done, accumulated, or without purification?
Yeah, those without regret and those without a remedy.
Okay.
Now, I think obviously those things need to be understood. There would be gradations, wouldn't there? Because just because you have a little bit of regret doesn't mean that you're not going to accumulate a karma. So we'd have to understand this. All right. All right. So let's leave that. Did that help? Good. Okay. Now, I just wanted to revisit something that Venerable Chodron started with in our last session with her. The section heading is called, in particular, the way to purify yourself by means of the four forces. Do you call them the four opponent powers?
Yes.
Okay. There in the Gomchen Lamrim it says, correct your transgressions with a procedure specific to each of the three kinds of ethical restraints. It is said that the best way to purify yourself of negativity is by means of the four forces. And then it goes into a description of the four opponent powers. So this is interesting. Correct your transgressions. Do you use the word transgression or downfall or meaning?
Negativity.
Hmm? When you've transgressed a vow is what it's referring to. Should we just transgression? Okay. So last time we did a slightly different, when we've done the possibilities, both, one not two, two not one, neither, when we do those possibilities, we just say, what are the possibilities between a transgression and a negativity? So a transgression here is going against a vow, breaking a vow. And a negativity is like a non-virtue. So what would be the possibilities between those two things? Is there something
that's... Good example, is there something that's
yes.
Both?
What is something that's both?
Oh, okay. Killing
you.
Breaks a vow and it's a negativity.
Okay. So killing is a transgression. Is it a transgression for everyone? Or would we have to be a little more specific?
Well, you have to, you have to have the vow.
Yeah. So we'd say something like killing incurred by a monastic or killing incurred by a person who possessed a vow not to kill. So we'd have to be very precise. Okay. Can you think of something that's a transgression but not a negativity?
Eating at...
I'm sorry?
Eating at... As a monastic, eating at improper times.
Right. As a monastic, eating at improper times. Why is it a transgression?
Because it's breaking one of our precepts.
And why is it not a negativity?
It's not generally considered to be non-virtuous.
Not naturally.
Right. Okay. Now, can you think of something that is a negativity but not a transgression? There's all sorts of debate about that. Let's see if we can come up with a cleaner example.
You know, that would be debate if the Buddha had a vow not to kill or not.
Well, he wasn't a Buddha yet. He was a Bodhisattva.
Right, even so.
And some people say that there was no negativity because he had such perfect, great compassion. And some people say, well, yes, of course, it was a natural negativity, so there was a small amount.
He
went to hell and bounced back out.
But wasn't a transgression.
Yeah, okay, so let's find another. Okay. Surely we can find another example. So what is a negativity but not a transgression?
Okay, killing for someone who doesn't have a vow.
Yeah. Killing for someone who doesn't have a vow.
Not to kill.
A vow not to kill. Thank you, that's precise. So it's a negativity because?
It's a naturally
negative act, and it's not a transgression because?
The person doesn't have a vow.
So this is a good way to work with these possibilities, is to really understand why is it one but not two? Why is it, or A, not B, B, not A? And then what is something that is neither? And you know, what we were encouraged to do is find something really close, you know, a really clever response. I mean, you could say a shoe, but that's not very challenging, is it?
So this is neither a transgression or a negative.
Right.
Whistling is a transgression.
What is whistling?
For who?
For a monastic.
Right.
So singing with attachment. Just like whistling, right?
It's funny you would pick that
one. I think we'd have to say singing or whistling for one without a vow to abstain from singing or whistling. It's not a negativity because?
Not naturally.
And it's not a transgression because?
We don't have a vow to do it.
Very good. So it's interesting to make a note of this, the relationship between these two things, because, for instance, a monastic who transgresses a vow not to kill an animal or an insect incurs both a negativity and a downfall. And these two are a single entity in that person's continuum. Have you heard that before? Mm. That the negativity and the downfall are a single entity, yet they're distinct. So we can even though they're a single entity, they can be purified individually through application of different techniques. So as the text said, we can correct our transgressions with the procedures specific to each of the three kinds of ethical restraint. I'm assuming he's talking about pratimoksha vows, bodhisattva vows, and tantric vows. So each of those vows come with instructions of how to purify them, don't they? How to reestablish them. Now, if you had generated a defeat or something similar to a defeat, then that's a whole other story for monastics. But in general, we can restore our vow, any vows that we've taken, like the refuge vow or the bodhisattva vow. Okay. But to purify the negativity, then we would apply the means of the four non-virtues. I'm sorry, the four opponent powers. Okay. So by applying the four opponent powers, then we can render that seed incapable of producing a fully ripened effect. And although that aspect has been purified through the four opponent powers, the transgression still remains on the mind until the person goes through the appropriate steps. Okay. Yes.
Lying is considered naturally negative?
Yes.
I think so. You know, I actually came up with some questions about this.
I think that when you take a vow, you're making a promise not to do something. When you break that, it becomes a lie. So how can not anything you do that breaks a vow, it could be argued then it's naturally negative because it becomes...
Because you've lied.
It turns your promise not to do that.
Interesting.
But is it, I don't know if I agree with that, because lying is defined as intentionally deceiving.
Yeah.
Okay, examples they give are quite different from that.
Yeah, that's true.
We did. At the time we took those things, where we start from is a strong belief that we have some ability not to do these things, knowing that we're going to break some of them, because if we, you know, as Nero always says, if we could already do all these things, we wouldn't need these precepts. Not like we're in a place where we think we're just going to blow it off left and right, but where we hold them as a value, and this is, I think, where the mental training side of it is nice to think about. Really, I don't think it's a lie when you break those things.
As long as you had the intention not to, when you took
it. Right. And with a not just like the simple mind of I'll never do this again, but with a mind that fully knows what we're capable of and that we're going to do our best, knowing that sometimes we're overcome by afflictions and other situations and conditions. We take, in my mind, I take these precepts with that kind of awareness, not a simple mind of I'll never do this again, thou shalt not.
Yeah. I think it's fair in the language. If we don't talk about vow, which general away from.
Yeah.
But if we talk about it in terms of ethical restraints, you know, then it has a different flavor in our mind, and so we can look at it more comfortably as guidelines and not about
shoulds.
Yeah, not about things that we're lying if we are overwhelmed by affliction.
Hmm.
That's
a good point.
Yeah. I have a lot of re-educating in my mind to do about
about that.
Venables, vocabulary. And, yeah. Okay, any questions from what we've discussed tonight? I hope that some of this has been clarifying.
That's been
helpful to go through it a second
time. Yeah.
us.
And probably a third and a fourth.
Yeah, we could do a few more.
So that it sticks.
Yeah.
Yeah. One thing that came to my mind, now when I arrived at the Abbey in January, Venerable was just starting the section on karma, and trying to figure out how to fit all my practices into a single day and make sure that I'm still meditating on the Lam Rim, other than a quick bodhicitta motivation and quick dedication with some emptiness, I had the idea that if I had been meditating on karma the whole time she was talking about it, I would have 3 or 4 months of meditation on karma under my belt, really using the topic in the period of time where it's being taught. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just offering that. This is my intention, that as we go forward from here, we're going to be starting the middle scope soon. Beautiful teachings on, you know, the first two noble truths in particular, developing renunciation and the 12 links. So, you know, if it fits, if it inspires you, then, you know, join me. And then, you know, we really get the benefit of this, these teachings. Otherwise, it's just like hearing things again and going, oh yeah, I remember that, oh yeah, I remember that, and then not really taking it deeply to get the transformation that we all want anyway. Okay, so with that, shall we leave it? We'll dedicate.